from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, an hour all about children and their future, as we check in first with Ted Lempert from Children Now on a recent county by county California study on the well-being of children in the state. And then we'll spend the rest of the hour with Marion Wright Edelman, president of the Children's Defense Fund and author of a new book called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, charting a course for the next generation. Forum is next after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's forum. In this forum hour, we talk with Marion Wright Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defense Fund and author of The Measure of Our Success and Lanterns and the recently published The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small, charting a course for the next generation. We'll talk with Marion Wright Edelman shortly, but we first wanted to check in with Ted Lempert of Children Now and find out about an important recently released California county by county study on the well-being of children, which graded 53 of the state's 58 counties at an overall grade rate level of C or below, and those other five only rated a B minus. And Ted Lempert is with us from Sacramento. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Michael. Good to be with you.
Good to have you here. Well, this report is called the 2008 California County Scorecard of Children's Well-Being, Creating Healthier Communities for Our Future. And some of the stuff's pretty grim. On the face of it, so many children saying they feel disconnected from adults, not feeling safe, and yet there's hope over on the horizon. But tell us about what you found out, generally.
Yeah, sure, Michael. As you noted, this is not a good report card. We, for the first time, graded each county in the state on key indicators in terms of children's education and health and safety. And only three counties received a B-, which was the highest grade. The rest received a C or lower. And just a couple of the key findings are preschool attendance, access to quality preschool, under half the kids in this state, and it went down as low as 23% in one county. Health insurance, we seem to be going the wrong direction after coming so close to getting almost all our kids insured. And as you noted, really what was most startling to me was some of these stats about children feeling safe at school and being connected to a caring adult. Less than a third of high schoolers report feeling safe at school, which is a real frightening statistic when you think about their ability to learn and just feel connected to society.
It's a better statistic, actually, for those in younger grades by about a third more. Huh?
Yes, that's correct.
And the breakdown, the Chronicle did an article about the study. They said there are more kids in San Francisco on the brink of depression and fewer dentist visits regularly in Napa. Some of these things are going to be a surprise to many people in Northern California counties within listening range here. Fewer parents read to the young in different counties like Santa Clara, Contra Costa, and Alameda. Again, we're talking about Northern California largely. These kinds of things, is there any sort of reason behind those kinds of statistics that you can determine?
Well, one of the surprises was that some of our Bay Area and urban counties didn't do better. The highest grade was a B- from Marin, and we actually thought that would be stronger. And I think you see really the need, regardless of how strong a local area feels they're doing in behalf of our kids, to really step up, and there needs to be a lot more support. The rural counties did better in that statistic in terms of parents reading to their kids, and I think really does highlight the need for strong parental involvement and support services, especially in some of the urban counties. But the other thing that really ran across all the counties was just how critical it is to really look at the child as a whole and really trying to be integrating these services as much as possible, making sure that we have health and social services at the school site. There's such a glaring lack of school nurses in our schools throughout the state, and hopefully this is really a wake-up call to each of the counties in this state to really prioritize kids and not just be giving lip service.
Well, they may be waking up, but the finances are getting tougher in this state and thinner. And so, what do you, in terms of triage, what do you particularly highlight as far as recommending to counties to pay attention to most of them?
Sure. Well, two things. I mean, clearly this is a statewide problem, and as tight as our finances are and will be becoming, we need to prioritize kids, and kids simply are not prioritized in the federal or state budget the way they need to be, and this hopefully will rally local leaders around the state to really put the pressure on. But locally, it does mean that if there are services for children at county centers or city centers, I think this report highlights we need to get them to where the kids are, and one of the things that does not cost a lot of money is really redirecting our services, trying to integrate the support and trying to ensure that services that already exist are sent to the school site. And you clearly see from the lack of counseling services and social services how disconnected our kids are feeling, and the way to help solve that is get those county and other government and nonprofit supports directly to the school site.
For those who want to go to your site and read the report, could you give out your website?
Absolutely. It's childrennow.org. We welcome you to go there, and you can connect to the report. And actually, you can go into each county and really look at the numbers behind this and see how your county is doing. And we'll be coming back in 2 years with an updated report, and hopefully we'll see these grades increase some.
Well, let's hope so. And Ted Lempert, thanks so much for joining us.
Pleasure.
Ted Lempert from Sacramento, president of Children Now, a national research and advocacy organization. They're based in Oakland, and he's a member of the San Mateo County Board of Education. Now we talk to Marion Wright Edelman, who, by the way, in her book talks about the future of children and talks about what really needs to be done for the next generation. Her book, again, is called The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. She talks not only about the 13 million underprivileged children in this country, the greatest gap of any industrialized nation between rich and poor, but also about what she describes as the cradle-to-prison pipeline and about the necessity really to change values, particularly equating, well, money with happiness and fame with success and those kinds of things. And good to have you here. Welcome.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
Well, there's so much in this book to talk about. But one of the things I guess I wanted to begin with is that it applies to all classes of people. Parenting is more difficult now than it is in the past.
Oh, I think so. I think there's so many more voices and noises out there that parents have to compete with. Children are sold, brands and taught to nag. They're a big consumer market. And so even in the womb, they're trying to addict children to nagging their parents about all the things that they must have that they don't need. You've got violence that is still glorified in our culture, and celebrity, which is glorified in our culture, and all the extrinsic values of money and power. And how does a parent try to begin to teach children that the things that are important are inside, is character, and not these things that society extols? Dr. King warned a long time ago about our preoccupation with excessive materialism. And as you note, I talk about children of poverty who are underprivileged and don't have their basic necessities met. But I talk about the overprivileged children who, have every material thing they can want, but are still morally and spiritually adrift and need the same kind of attention and parental guide setting that every child needs.
The biggest drug problems and the biggest sometimes behavior problems are in both sides of the continuum. I mean, impoverished and the affluenza kids, as you call them.
The affluenza kids, is right.
And there's a sense, you say it at one point, you say adults are what's wrong with children.
Oh, when people ask me why we're having all these problems with our children, killing children and being killed and hanging out in the streets and engaging in drugs and alcohol, I say, well, it's adults. The biggest single problem I think that children face is adult hypocrisy. I mean, when you look at the figures, there's an indictment of adults in a variety of roles. I mean, the fact that we've got a child born into this very rich nation every 33 seconds into poverty. We've got a child neglected or abused every 35 seconds without health insurance every 39 seconds. Killed by guns every 3 hours. We have the equivalent of Virginia Tech slaughter of 32 young people and others and adults every 4 days. And yet we adults seem not to see our children crying out for help, and we're not meeting their most basic needs to care and nurturance and survival and protection. And we need to wake up and stop dropping the ball of responsibility in our homes, in our communities, and in our public life.
You've mentioned, protection, but also direction and attention. I mean, these are kind of the triad of what you've been, at least in this book, advocating for years. By the way, this book is published on the 35th anniversary, we should add, in fact, the Children's Defense Fund. And
wouldn't it be nice to have been out of business by now? I would have hoped I would have been.
Well, congratulations. I mean, you certainly are one of our leading, have been one of our leading preeminent children's advocates, and I think it was Bill Clinton who compared you to Marian Anderson in terms of your voice, and the voice has been one that has certainly not been heard enough where children are concerned. At one point, though, I found myself actually wondering about a couple of things. When you say children need mothers and fathers, I thought, does that somehow mean that gay and lesbian couples perhaps are in a different category?
No, not necessarily. They just need as many caretakers who are going to make them first in their lives and provide them the nurturing. That was really aimed at fathers because we tend to think that it's primarily women and mothers who are the caregivers, and that is still true in the overwhelming majority of cases. But I'm really trying to talk about the need for all parents to step up to the plate and to place their children first. And for young men, I remember when we were doing our first teen pregnancy prevention campaign, trying to get the boys in there and saying, hey, fatherhood doesn't end with conception. You've got a responsibility here. And neither men nor women nor anybody should sit here and think about having a child unless they're, ready and to be responsible for that child until they can reach safe adulthood. So it's a message to all of us. And I think that when children don't have parents or when they have parents that can't meet all their functions, and parents can't, they need communities and they need public supports. I mean, parents can't be blamed if the jobs in their plant move abroad or if, they're working two or three jobs and employees don't provide health insurance, so we should get over talking about parents alone can raise anybody. They need support systems, but everybody must, if they decide that they're going to have children, take responsibility for those children. And parenting is serious business. We don't prepare people very much for it, and we don't support them. We talk a lot about family values, but our policies don't really support parents, particularly those who are not able to provide for the material things that their children need, or buy their own health insurance or buy fancy schools or have all their material needs met. So we need to step up to the plate and look at what all children need, because all children are going to make up America's future.
Yeah, I know you've been close friends for many years with Senator Clinton, and I couldn't help thinking it takes a village. Village keeps kind of coming through here in your book.
It's an old African proverb, and village, community, herd. I have a story in there about the water buffalo family, or the herd, or the posse, whatever it is.
But I like that story. Let's tell it.
I love that story.
Yeah.
It's on YouTube, and one of the most watched videos on YouTube of a herd of water buffalo grazing at a watering hole. Unbeknownst to them, a pride of six lions were poised to attack, and a family, I assume, with a baby calf got too disconnected from the herd, and the lions got close to them and pounced, and by the time they saw the lions, it was too late. The whole herd turned and ran. The little baby calf couldn't keep up, and predators always go after the most vulnerable. And I was very upset when I saw the parents moving away, running away along with the herd, and then saw the lions grab the baby calf. And they happily fell into a river, I guess, because that bought time. And when they fell into the river, the alligators came and wanted their piece of the prey. And so there was this tug between the alligators and the lions. And the thing that amazed me again was the resiliency of the child, who was struggling to now get rid of both predators. The lions won, pulled the baby up on the land, I was with a group of women. We were at a spiritual retreat at the Haley Farm in January. We were watching this, and we all screamed in such relief that the baby had been pulled on the land, was still alive, amazingly. But then we realized that the baby was about to be devoured by these lions. And then you heard a noise and saw a herd of water buffalo returning to rescue this child. And there was an initial fear. They saw these lions, even though it was six, they were greatly outnumbered. They backed off. But then, whom I just know was the mom, the mother sort of with her horns came and threw one lion off angrily. Some of the others came and tried to run the lions off, but others tried to get around the child and pull him away and rescue him. And this tug went on two or three times. But the bottom line is that the child was rescued. The herd moved away with the child, and some were left to run away the remaining lions. But then we were screaming by this time that this baby, miraculously, had been rescued, and said, well, wasn't that strategic of the parents to go and try to seek help? And wasn't it marvelous that they had help they could seek? But then I thought, where's the herd of the posse for children today who are being
Where's our community posse?
Where's our community posse for for the children against the drug dealers and the gangs and others? The church doors and mosque doors are too often closed. The drug fellas are open 24/7, and our children don't have positive alternatives and havens for the streets. And so I think, again, this breakdown in community responsibility and adult responsibility to rescue children, it was so clear that if that herd had not come back, that child was a goner. And so many of our children are gone. I mean, I was at a youth camp in near Los Angeles recently talking to a group of young boys in a secure detention facility and asked them what is it they feared most. And to a person, 15 to 18, it was the assumption they were going to die. And the violence in their communities and the lack of any safe place that they could go to escape the daily threats in their lives in these war zones of our neighborhoods. You know, we can do better than that. We've got to do better than that.
It's a good allegory, the story you tell about the lions. And it's also, though, a real story that you tell that applies to much of what you want to bring across in your book. And that's what happens or has happened in Wake County, North Carolina.
Well, the country had better wake up because we are in the middle of this economic debacle, and it's going to pale compared to our loss of competitiveness and leadership by producing a generation of illiterate children unable or children unable to compete in a globalizing economy. And a child drops out of school in this country every 10 seconds of the school day. A majority of all of our children of all ages and races cannot, and income groups, cannot read at grade level in 4th, 8th, or 12th grade. And by 12th grade, usually about half have dropped out. Over 80% of Black and Hispanic children cannot read at grade level in 4th, 8th, and 12th grade. And over 90% cannot do math. Now, what are you going to do in this economy if you can't read or compute? These figures are the moral and economic Achilles heel to America's survival. If we don't invest in our human capital, our children have got to compete not only with each other, they've got to compete with Indian children and Chinese children and European children in this globalizing world where you got to know how to think. You can't predict what are going to be the jobs in the next 5-10 years. You got to learn how to think and move quickly and digest and make judgments from reams of information. And they need a moral context for making those judgments as well. But this failure to educate, we've got lots of wonderful schools, individual schools. We know how to teach kids to read. We've got wonderful private schools. We've got some wonderful public schools. We don't have a whole lot of wonderful public school systems that teach all children to read. And one of the groups I highlight, one system I do highlight in the book is Wake County, which is Raleigh, North Carolina, where when you get leadership, high expectations that all children can learn, clear goals, the business community coming together with community networks and with first-rate school leadership, you work and recognize that school achievement begins at birth, and you've got to have a strong early childhood system, a high-quality early childhood system, that what goes on outside the school affects the whole child, and children don't come in pieces, and they spend only 17% of their time in schools. And so you've got to pay attention to what happens after school, in the summers, on weekends. How do you support parents supporting their children's learning? And so you've got to address the whole child. And in Wake County, where they have tried to make all these connections and build this network of support within and without schools, you're seeing the achievement levels go up dramatically, where, you know, they're outpacing all North Carolina school districts and are outpacing in the achievement level of all of their children, most national schools.
That's impressive. We're talking again with Marion Wright Edelman. Her new book is The Sea is So Wide and My Boat is So Small. And the book is set up as letters, largely letters to parents, to teachers and educators, to faith leaders and young people and her own grandchildren, among others in the different sections. You say that teachers really need to love children, and you talk about and think children are sacred. And I found myself thinking, really, is that necessary? Remember those tough teachers who probably didn't love us, but nevertheless, you talk about the importance of structure, taught us about structure, taught us in ways that were really very efficacious and didn't necessarily think of us as being sacred or love us in any way. I mean, I know this in a high ideal, in the best of all possible worlds, that'd be great. But then I'm thinking to myself, no, you got a lot of tough teachers out there who are very good teachers. They don't necessarily love kids. They're just good teachers.
Well, But the fact that they chose teaching says that there's something in the fact that they were tough and wanted to make you succeed. I call that love. I mean, there's such a thing as good old tough love. I mean, discipline is not the opposite of love. But I think that it is very important, and that's one of the big problems in this country, is that we don't honor our creed. We don't think that all people are created equal with certain inalienable rights. We don't create a level playing field for all children. And so despite our Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, we have been struggling not to be hypocrites all of our history. And we need to kind of move into recognition that I believe that all of us as adults and respecting each other is that everybody's sacred, that every human being is sacred and is entitled to certain things as a matter of just being here, including health care, including education, which is a basic tool. And I'm really trying to address teachers who are unfair to children or who don't like children. Teaching after parenting is one of the most important things in the world. I quote Gabriela Mistral, the Nobel laureate, who was a teacher who thought it was one of the most sacred callings. And I just try to get everybody to go into teaching. I'm very pleased that I kept all three of my sons out of law school, and the two of them are working very hard to make sure that children get a strong early childhood education and get educated. But, you know, children who have not had their confidence built up or who are in families that can't always meet their needs need to be able to go to school and have somebody who believes in them, has high expectations for them, are not going to let them fail, are going to work out. And I mean, when I was growing up, boy, we were going to read or else. We were going to learn our math and chemistry or else. And I count that as love because they were preparing us to survive and thrive and contribute in society. And so I tell people, go into teaching. It's a crucial, I think, benchmark, beachhead for the civil rights movement of this new era. But if you don't love children, please get out of it. I mean, just don't go near them, because you can have the fanciest classroom building and the smallest class size, but if children feel that you don't respect them and don't believe in them and are not there to get them to learn, it's not going to work.
Well, let me go through some more do's and don'ts from Marion Wright Edelman, just to give the listeners kind of a broad view here. Don't be a buddy or a friend to your child, which I think is excellent advice. Don't let the internet and the TV raise your children. Do read to them. Keep them off the streets. Develop their character, all of those kinds of things. But also teach boys to take care of the toilet seat and and outlaw. And I looked at this. I said the N, B, and H words, and I didn't know what I knew what the N word was. I certainly knew what the B word was. The H word, for a minute, stymied me, and then I thought, it's ho.
It's ho.
Yeah, kids shouldn't use those words, and they should be taught not to use those words.
And adults shouldn't use those words, but you know they learned it someplace from us.
Well, again, it's your thesis, again, that adults are what's wrong with children. This is an attempt to chart a course for the next generation. It comes out on the 35th anniversary of the Children's Defense Fund, which has really been inseparable from Marion Wright Edelman's leadership. She's also, of course, the author of the number one New York Times bestselling book, The Measure of Our Success. And I'm going to open up our phone lines and invite those of you to join us. There's a lot in here about reforming the juvenile justice system, about how to break down that what she calls cradle-to-prison pipeline. But really what it is all about is putting children first. And I would put the question to you, our listeners, how do we transform and provide the kind of hope which can put children first, which must put children first if we're to legitimize our future and really realize a future that may be the one that we all as a village share, or a community share. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. Please join the program. Any questions or comments are welcome. It's 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from wherever you're listening to Forum or however, 866-733-6786. Or you can join us by email, and our email address is simply forum@kqed.org. Talking again with Marion Wright Edelman, who will be at Dominican University tonight in San Rafael at 7:30 in the Guzman Lecture Hall. And when we return, we'll hear from you. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Marion Wright Edelman, who is the founder of the Children's Defense Fund. They're celebrating 35 years, and to celebrate, to some extent, that 35th anniversary, she's put out a new book called The Sea Is So Wide and My Boat Is So Small, charting a course for the next generation. We heard from Ted Lempert at the top of the hour, who has been heading up a Children's Now National Research and Advocacy Organization group with a lot of new statistics about, well, grim statistics about Northern California and California counties, county by county. And certainly Marion Wright Edelman brings some of those statistics to bear. In fact, you've heard her citing, you know, every 10 seconds and every 20 minutes and so forth throughout the course of our dialogue here. But there's a good deal of hope in this book about the future, and the future, of course, depends on all of us as far as she's concerned. There's a good deal of also, I was noticing that she's wearing cameos of Harriet Tubman and Sojourner Truth, and they get a lot of play in your book. But, well, so does Dr. King, of course, so does Thurgood Marshall. It's clear who your idols are, Jane Addams. But Gandhi keeps coming back, and Thoreau. I mean, the idea, I guess, of civil disobedience plays or has played a preeminent role in your thinking in many respects in terms of getting things done, clearly, going back to the civil rights movement. And
well, I'm a child of the civil rights movement, and I do believe in nonviolence. And it is, it's time to begin to teach it again, because I think we're not doing serious nonviolence conflict resolution. Or again, Dr. King warned about our reliance on militarism, which has taken us over the edge, and that's not going to bring peace in the world. And so,
but also, forgive me, teaching our children about resolving conflict too, right. Nonviolent. You know?
Nonviolently. I mean, we are a violent society. I mean, we have lost, as you will note in my letter to Dr. King, over 2 million Americans to violence since 1968, when Dr. King and Robert Kennedy died. Warning about the menace of violence to all of us, and that none of us were safe from it, and we haven't listened to them. 1.2 million of those died from guns, and guns are everywhere. Children can get guns in some areas more quickly than they can get a library card. And another 750,000 have died from violence, knives, and other means. But what's going to take us to stop this war?
It's hard to listen to the words of Dr. King and Bobby Kennedy when you have this popular culture that's so glorifying of violence.
Well, that's right.
And how you change that, particularly when you have this machinery that just keeps churning it out for children.
Well, it's turning it out for children, but again, it gets back to our reliance on violence and war as a way of solving everything. And one of the reasons I want to stop and say, hey, stop. Here we're living in such a nuclear precarious world where, you know, we can, rogue nations and rogue terrorists may have access to nuclear weapons. And here we have our own leaders crazily talking about more effective nuclear weapons. I mean, what in the world? Yeah, if you think we've lost our sense. You've got guns everywhere, and an NRA in charge of our gun policy, as if assault weapons have anything to do with the Second Amendment, the right to possess arms. You've got children being killed by guns every 3 hours. I mean, I point out that since we began to keep statistics of gun deaths for children in 1979, we have lost twice as many children in our country to gunfire than we have lost in the Vietnam War and the Afghan and Iraqi War up through April. What we have this relentless chronic war. So we've got to try another way. And Dr. King, drawing on the history of Mr. Thoreau, and I loved it, Mr. Thoreau, and Mr. Tolstoy, how you must not be discouraged. You must sort of keep saying what is right and what makes sense and what's going to bring about peace, because clearly, the way we're going is not going to be a good one. But you know, Mr. Gandhi read Mr. Tolstoy, and Mr. King read Mr. Gandhi, and Mr. Thoreau came back to America from seeding this. I mean, from Thoreau to Tolstoy to Gandhi to King.
You can connect the dots.
We can connect the dots, and it is an idea we need to rethink again. And Dr. King warned us that our choice is no longer between violence and nonviolence, it's between nonviolence and nonexistence. And so it's time to say stop the killing. Stop the killing within our own nation. Stop the killing of children and each other. And stop the killing of other people in other nations. And let's begin not to breed a new era of terrorists, which we've now seen cannot be controlled. Our borders are totally porous in every way. And take some lessons from 9/11. So the letter to Dr. King was really one of the ones that I hope people will really focus on, because he told us just that the dangers of violence and racism and militarism and materialism would destroy us, and we need to listen to him. We celebrated him, and we memorialize him, and we've also sanitized him, but we need to follow him. And so I hope people will look at that letter very seriously.
We're going to go to your calls and emails here. Just one other question I'm sort of behooves me to ask you, because you've written about Bristol Palin's pregnancy and said it sparked a conversation about teen pregnancy in America. Has this been a productive conversation? Has it been a good conversation?
Well, it needs to become one. And I think it reminds us that teen pregnancy, like so many of the problems that the Children's Defenseman address, are equal opportunity threats, and that there are more white than black children who get pregnant every year and who have babies, and that it's not something that is relegated to poor black kids in inner cities. And we need to stop our overall hypocrisy of telling young girls not to get pregnant before they're able to raise a child, and then put, you know, out of wedlock mothers on the back of People magazine and glamorize it and make it an okay thing to have babies out of wedlock. And so, again, it gets back to the adult, confused adult signals. And I do hope all of those folk who stepped up to the plate in support of Palin will be supportive of policies that are going to enable these young women to get the health care that they need, the prenatal care that they need, the parenting assistance that they need and all young people need, the child care that they need to stay in school. And so I hope that the hypocrisy that is too often characterize some of the more conservative networks will be felt in policies that are going to really make sure that we support those young women and young men to become better parents and to become educated and not to be just ostracized.
Well, I'll talk about hypocrisy. Somebody sent me, I think it was on YouTube, Bill O'Reilly, the infamous commentator and bully, was talking about Britney Spears' sister being pregnant out of wedlock and was excoriating the parents and saying, obviously, the parents have not done their job and what pinheads they are, and words to that effect. And then when Sarah Palin's daughter was pregnant, it was a whole different... I mean, partisan politics even gets into something like that. It was, you know, people should leave them alone and they shouldn't bother them and, you know, this is their private matter. In other words, he was taking two completely, almost antithetically different positions depending on, you know, his politics, obviously.
Well, there's not a whole lot of consistency in a lot of the politics, and partisan politics invades everything. But the bottom line is that a child has a child every minute. We produce the equivalent of Atlanta every year with children having children. We need to wake up. We need to talk to our children about sex as a reality. We need to challenge some of the sexually charged messages in our popular culture. But then we need to make sure that our young people get what they need, have positive purpose. The two largest predictors, even though this is something that cuts across class and race, of who is going to become a teen parent, a basic skills level in poverty. And when you hold those two variables constant, you have identical rates between black, white, and Latino girls. The problem is, you know, we need to sort of see these things. Talk to our children. Talk to our boys. Talk to our girls. Tell our boys not to score as macho, to go out and do all these things. But then when they make mistakes, then for goodness sakes, rather than just judge them or put them out of the house, let's figure out how we try to break the cycle and give them the support they need so they can stay in school and become productive, independent parents.
Well, it's hard, especially these parents who are just trying to put stuff on the table and don't even have enough time to... Well, let's go to our callers and see what they have to say here. Andrea, good morning.
Good morning.
Andrea,
good morning.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Hi. My question is, I'm a mother, and my resources, personal, financial, are fairly stretched. I think as a nation, we are very stretched for resources, and I know all the teachers in my life feel like they have so much to do, and I was hoping I could get some guidance from you as to what you think the top 1, 2, or 3 priorities should be for each of those categories. What should I be doing as a mother for my children? What should the teachers be doing for the kids? And what should the government be doing for the children? Not all of it, because I don't know that we can really attack all of it at once. And when we hear all of it together, it feels sort of overwhelming. What do you think the most important things are?
Well, I try to lay out what can be done in each of the letters to each of folk. But I think that the key thing for parents is you love your children. You pay attention and take time with them. They don't need a whole lot of things. They need to be able to sit down with meals and to have somebody who's open and listening and available to them. So I think that the key is the love and the consistent attention. I'm amazed at how few times many American families sit down and just have a meal. And so the socialization process and the interaction with caring adults on a regular basis is very important. So just be present to them. I think as a teacher, the important thing is to have high expectations and to respect those children. I talk about, I'm assuming if you're in teaching, you know it's a mission and that you love these kids. But that you just really let children know that they can succeed and you work with them to succeed and that you believe in them. We celebrate children here in California and around the country who beat the odds despite homelessness and violence at home and violence in the streets and incarcerated parents because some teacher or some counselor reached out to them and said, I believe in you and you can make it. And we have about 600 of these young leaders now, and they are doctors and lawyers and Peace Corps volunteers because of that one positive gesture that says, I believe in you and I'm going to help you make it. I think in terms of public policy, and I lay out an agenda in the Cradle of Prison Pipeline chapter, is the first thing we've got to do in 2009 is to get every child born as healthy as we can with prenatal care, not at low birth weight, by having a basic system of comprehensive health care for every child and pregnant mother. Now, we've had our candidates promise universal health care for everybody.
You just did an hour on it, in fact.
I'm sorry I missed that, most of it. And I hope everybody, we're long overdue in getting a health care system for every American. But if we can't get everybody, because our national house has been robbed here, and we're going to hear all the lack of money, I hope because the CHIP bill, the State Children's Health Insurance Program comes up in March again for extension or for refunding. And President Bush vetoed it twice. Our Congress said that they couldn't afford $70 billion to cover all children and pregnant women, which is what CDF wanted. The Children's Defense Fund worked for an All Healthy Children's Act. And I don't think God made two classes of children. Therefore, I think all children should get health care. In California, we've seen for 10 years our inability to get all California's children covered.
Well, that's in Senator Obama's plan.
But we're not going to get it unless citizens speak up. And one of my basic things is if we adults can't get it for everybody, we've been debating universal health care for about 6 decades, and I hope we do get it for everybody in 2009. But if we cannot get that in 2009, all of us must be clear to our leaders that we must get all children and all pregnant women to at least try to have a level playing field from birth. It's cost effective. I say it's hogwash that they couldn't find $70 billion to cover all 9 million uninsured children and the 750,000 women who have babies every year. And look how quick they could find that $700 billion. So when they come back and say in March that we want to just cover 4 or 5 million and not reform the system and give all children comprehensive benefits, I hope that everybody will say no. You got to get them all. And the American public in our focus groups and polls have said they want all children first. And so I hope we'll end up in 2009.
Speaking about all children first, where are you on No Children Left Behind?
Well, I'm trying to avoid it as much as I can. We need to make some significant changes to it. There ought to be accountability, but you've got to address teacher quality. You can't just rely on testing, over-rely on testing. And so I think we need to really get back to some basics, small classroom sizes, teacher quality, attract better teachers in there, school construction. But there are a lot of things that need to be included.
And safe schools, as you...
Safe school. Yeah. Safety comes first. But again, that gets back to really trying to look at out-of-school time as well as in-school time.
Dedosio. Good morning. Welcome to
Good
Forum.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a question, and I'll take my answer off air. Is I find in modern society, because of divorces and families coming together and you have stepchildren involved, that in many cases, men are not allowed to be fathers to provide disciplinary or guidance and direction to the young boys, and in some cases, young girls as well. And I'd like to know your opinion on that matter to kind of get a sense of what you feel is the right approach to dealing with that.
Thank you, Dedosio.
I believe that fathers as well as mothers are important in children's lives. I had a great, great father, and that partnership between mother and father and high expectations for girls as well as boys, very important. And so I hope that fathers will struggle to stay engaged with their children if there happens to be a separation in the family, and to support them financially, to support them emotionally, and for goodness sakes, don't get the children in the middle of whatever's wrong with the parents. The child must come first. And so I applaud your interest in staying engaged, and I hope that fathers across will continue to maintain their responsibility for their children.
Nari is our next caller. Welcome, Nari.
Hi. I just wanted to call and make a comment about children today and with parents as well. I think parents are a little bit confused these days on what creates a strong and confident child. They seem to be raising very self-centered individuals that don't seem to have much of a connection of others and community, and they don't see how their actions really affect other people. And I don't see that they're really raising children that are passionate on any level, and that seems to be expanding out to the world in general, especially with what's happening with our economy right now, how what's happening in our country is also affecting other countries, and how we really are all interconnected and not just individuals.
Well, we keep hearing about the millennial generation and how they're less connected to community, to society, to each other even, more self-absorbed, more self-concerned, and this seems to be kind of trickling down into generations coming after them. I don't know if you perceive things that way, Marion Wright.
I do perceive things that way in many ways. On the other hand, when I've seen the re-engagement of young people in this political process for the first time, they have a sense of hope and somebody's appealed to their best self. And it feels like I felt in 1960 or 1959 with the civil rights movement. I just hope that this engagement in the political process can carry over into trying to build a movement to transform our priorities. But I think that technology has been a mixed blessing. I think it's both can bring young people together, but it also separates them from adults in some ways. And it's a disconnection from community. I think that, again, it gets back to what are the adult role models that they see and live with every day doing. I think it's very important that we take children with us, that the children see us trying to serve. We have and they want to feel useful. They want to feel engaged. We have created Freedom Schools, building on the Mississippi Summer Project of 1964, and we have about 138 of them across the country that serve about 9,000 children each year. And college students are coming to teach. We train them down at the former Alex Haley Farm near Knoxville, Tennessee. And we try to teach these young people they can make a difference. These are for children 5 to 15. And so they learn how to read, to love to read. They learn about prior role models. They learn about the Birmingham Children's March. They learn how children brought down racial apartheid in this country and desegregating schools and all the other. And they learn that they can make a difference and they have to engage in some service. They have to engage in civic activity. You should see the senators' faces when hundreds of children walk in to say, why are you not providing me health care? And they see role models who grew up in very difficult circumstances who are coming back to give them. And we engage parents in weekly parent workshops. And so, I can watch the children begin to get it, that it's about community. It's about us feeling connected to something that's bigger than ourselves.
But you're connecting it to education. You're saying that one relies on the other. It's symbiotic.
It's symbiotic, and it's parent role. It's what, again, the churches are doing. I mean, many of our freedom schools are in churches. It's what the adult neighbors are doing, and they do what adults do and not what we tell them to do. So if we're serving and if we're trying to work in community and we're going to the homeless kitchens on weekends and taking them along, they'll kind of get it.
Well, we'll get more of our calls on. And Lyra, good morning. Welcome to Forum.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. My name's Lyra, and I'm actually the executive director of an agency, a small one in the Peninsula area. We've been around 12 years, and it's so great to hear someone talking about teachers and talking about what we call resiliency. You might have actually said that earlier, and this concept that if a child has someone in their life, most often a teacher who believes in them and has high expectations, they're going to succeed, and all the work we do is actually in the classroom to build teachers' capacity to promote social, emotional, and behavioral wellness. And my one question around this is the one thing that we would love to hear something about is the idea of cultural competency. We don't have a teaching population that necessarily reflects the student population, and it's a lot of our work is around cultural competency and around just trying to build capacity in terms of making a connection and a relationship for each child. So I was curious if you have any thoughts around that.
Well, I think that cultural competence is terribly important in every child-serving agencies. We have been working to create that kind of curriculum in our freedom schools, and we'd love to have schools begin to look at it because it is very important to understand the context in which these children come. It is very important that we do that in all of our child-saving institutions because if you don't see and understand the home situation of a child, the community situation from a child, you're often going to make judgments that don't really relate to what that child needs. And so cultural competency in every child-serving institution and recruiting a more diverse workforce in all of our child-serving agencies that are child-focused, very, very important. And I hope you might go to our website, look up our Freedom Schools, talk to them about the kind of curriculum we developed.
Give out your website.
www.childrensdefense.org, and you can get childrensdefense.california.org here. But I think that trying to really have a more integrated and diverse workforce in every area, but focused in on understanding the whole child, because children don't come in pieces, and being culturally competent is very, very important. A lot of young people who are being put into the cradle to prison pipeline by judges who don't have any understanding about where these children come from and the kinds of lives they've come from.
I understand it. We've done programs on the juvenile justice system here. The judges can't even really have time enough to make any kind of reasonable, discreet, or prudent decision. Things move along so fast.
They move along so fastly, but we've been working with juvenile court judges over the years and have tried to create some culturally competent curriculum, and many are now beginning to change and are deeply concerned that we're criminalizing younger and younger children. And they come in and they say that some of them are so young they can't even see their heads over the desk, and they know we've got to stop and break up this pipeline and begin to make sure that our earlier prevention and early intervention systems work. And it's too late by the time they get to many of the judges, and we've got a reverse course. I mean, it's so dumb that here in California you're spending almost four times more per prison than per public school pupil. And so for those who say we don't have the money to do this, this is the best investment policy we can make.
Here's an appropriate email from a listener. By the way, if you've just joined us, we're talking with one of America's preeminent children's advocates, Marion Wright Edelman, and she'll be at Dominican University this evening at 6:30. Doors open. She'll be there 7:30, and it'll be a book signing for her new book. The sea is so wide and my boat is so small, charting a course for the next generation. She'll be talking there in San Rafael. This is a listener who writes, in Japan, spending per pupil is equal across the country. This is the single most important factor in creating parity. Also, universal preschool. Teachers are paid a professional wage and are probably the most respected single group of people in the country. I'd add, by the way, they're also woefully underpaid, as anybody who knows much about Japanese culture knows. But I think the caller wants a response to that, I mean, and how that paradigm might work here, or if it would work here.
The Japanese, I spent a summer in Japan looking at their children's policy, and they understand that their economic competitiveness depends on their investment in children. And they have too few children, they think. But they make a very big deal about investing in all their children. I used to dream, because the data systems in America are so bad for children, and I used to think, well, you could really have a one-stop shop for all the things that a parent needs, and you can go and get your needs diagnosed and dealt with. Well, I went to Tokyo, and my goodness, I think, as I recall, when I was there in the mid-80s, there were 12 of them in Tokyo. And I would sit in these Japanese early childhood centers and their education things. They have a centralized policy because it is a national priority that their children become extremely well-educated and productive.
Lots of pressure on those
and
children.
I was trying to remember the numbers. I think that the time I was there, there was a new big crisis in teenage pregnancy. I think it was like 20,000 children had gotten pregnant in the entire country, and you would have think they were mobilizing for World War II. The whole government was being organized to figure out how they're going to figure out why this is happening and how do we respond. And so this centralized government capacity to mobilize to deal with their economic and human resource development is something that we're lacking here.
But not the academic pressure there.
The academic pressure is enormous. Terrible. I mean, I used to ask, are children happy in Japan? I mean, the pressure is enormous, and there's, you know, bullying and suicides are deep concern in Japan. And I was very struck when I went out to Tokyo University of Todai, as they call it, and saw how filthy the place was then. I mean, it's when they know they're going to go back and be slotted the top young people into corporations for the rest of their lives. And so they have this period of letting it all hang out and of rebellion. I couldn't believe it. No university in America would look like this, but they go back in and they conform and they produce. But the centralized government policy and the understanding that we don't have here, that children are central to national competitiveness and well-being, is one that we lack, and we'd better wake up and realize it.
Another email from a listener named Elizabeth, who says, I'm a stay-at-home mother of three who was a teacher before I had children. I believe we should pay women or men who want to stay home with their kids. I love being home with them. But if we could afford to pay someone to help me have a break or with the housework, I would be a better mother and have more of myself to give to them.
Well, I believe in choice. I believe in paid parental leave. We got unpaid parental leave and the world didn't collapse and it needs to be expanded. And so I think we ought to look at how we can give parents choices. And
we do it in Scandinavia.
Though a lot of the men feel the pressure still not to take it. And it's still, but at any rate, it would be very nice to sort of have parents have the option to choose to stay at home and take care of their children, and not to stay at home if they can't or don't choose to, and that should be men as well as women. And I think one of the platforms that we hope that some new Congress and administration will put forward soon is that we'll have paid sick leave and paid parental leave, and that we can move towards supporting parents in a wide variety of ways.
And here's a testament to having you on here. This listener says, for me, the real value of Forum is that every few weeks or so, we hear the voice and thoughts of a sane person, like an oasis in the midst of poor thinking. That's from a listener named Brian. So
thank you.
We have time for me for one more call. And Andrea, that's you. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. Yeah. Mrs. Zittleman, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on what our responsibilities as parents are in terms of our children's education. The statistics you cited earlier in the program about our public education system are really frightening, but I think we also have a lot of expectations of our educational system. And I'd love to hear what you think what we can be doing as parents are to foster our children's education.
Oh, I think what goes on in the home is so important. One is you read and read and read and read to them, and you talk to them, and you expose them to as many experiences. I mean, the wonder of children is so incredible that I can't turn off the television set. I say this in the letter to parents. Turn off the computer and the video games, and sit down and interact with your children. Really give them a sense that reading and achieving is important and fun. Don't make it a grind. Encourage them to keep diaries. You forget so much, and help them cultivate the interest in writing. But I think that parents in the interaction, and one of the scariest studies is one that came out of Kansas City some years ago, who looked at the parents of affluent children and those of poor mothers on welfare, and found that by age 3, there was already a 30 million word interaction gap. Talking to children, you can't teach what you don't know, which is why we've got to break the cycle and why we've got to engage with parents as well as with children. But reading and talking and conversation, very important.
Well, a good way for parents to begin is with their own reading, or for that matter, educators. Policymakers, the sea is so wide and my boat is so small is the book Charting a Course for the Next Generation by Marion Wright Edelman. So good to have had you here. Thank you so much.
Lovely being here. Thank you.
And we are here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. One of our hours is repeated 10 p.m. in the evening. I want to extend thanks to Senior Editor Dan Zoll and to our producers, Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And Forum's Executive Producer is Raul Ramirez. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.